I was literally on the first vacation I had taken in a couple years. I was in Aruba with my family, including my parents. And, you know, we're sitting there one night, you know, watching TV, like a late edition of CNN International, I think. You know, and the news comes on, Rudy Gobert of the Utah Jazz, right? Kind of like he was the first like confirmed case of COVID in the NBA. And I was like, that's it. It's over.
Welcome to episode 17 of the David Binkowski Podcast. Today we have to talk with co-founder of Kindred, his company that officially launched this week, Ian Schaefer. Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, David.
Now, it's a pleasure having you on. You and I go back, having met in person, to what I'll call our kind of New York City agency days.
Back when that was a thing.
Yeah, and you founded an agency called Deep Focus.
Yep.
And I was just starting up large media, and we met for coffee by our old Manhattan headquarters to talk some shop. And God, it feels like forever ago.
It does. It does. But I remember it like it was yesterday.
Yeah. And I remember being in meetings because you had a client, if not two, that when I worked for somebody else, we were in the room together. You and I weren't, but your team was. And I remember sitting there thinking about how smart it was, like, to get into digital advertising, when you did, you know, as a startup, essentially after a recession. I thought that was smart.
Yeah.
Because you get to build it differently, you know, than what, I mean, you and I looked, we had the same approach. We looked at the agency landscape and we're like, this ain't working. So, you know, it was interesting from that standpoint. When you first started the agency, you know, where did you find that inspiration or where did you see, where's that, the biggest opportunity to just walk in and start taking business?
So as I look back on it, I may not have realized it at the time, but this is something maybe a little bit of age gives you perspective on, is that I had a chip on my shoulder. And it was a chip that was like a multidimensional chip. But it was a chip, and at the time I was working at Miramax Films. And so I had like a Harvey Weinstein sized chip on my shoulder about that. On the other side of that, I just, one of the things that I've learned about myself over the years is that I get obsessive about fixing things that I see are broken. And that could be, you know, like a piece of electronics, or it could be an entire industry. And I was looking at the entertainment industry and I was looking at the advertising industry. And I was thinking to myself, wow, like these industries are incredibly unprepared for what's about to happen. You know, after spending a lot of time, you know, on the entertainment side, not just speaking with the studios and cable networks, but also the emerging social media platforms, which, again, in 2001, there were a handful. But you kind of saw the seeds being planted for what the future was going to bring. And I just said, if I like game theory this out, the world is going to be a completely different place in 5 years. And none of these agencies know what's coming. So, like, what? Like, it's almost like finding the almanac, that sports almanac in Back to the Future, right? And saying, like, I can place, I know the Cubs are going to win. So it's like, I can place my bets on this and build for the future that I know is coming. And, you know, coming out of 2001, you know, after, you know, September 11th, after the, you know, economy tanked, you know, so many companies had to retrench, but, you know, starting a company in that time, I mean, it's like the theory of relativity. You feel like you're moving twice as fast as everybody else. And by the way, it seems to the clients that you are too, because instead of trying to retrofit into the things that are changing, you're able to build for what things are changing into. And I think that just, you know, motivated me from, like, that was the optimistic side of the motivation, but the pessimistic side was, man, all these things are broken. These systems are completely broken. You know, the incentives are all misaligned. And it was just, it was time. And for me, it's like, you know, part of the challenge was building something successful, right? Like with my bare hands, you know, part of it was, you know, leaving a legacy in its wake. And it's like, you know, if I do this right, I want to be able to, you know, it's like the Steve Jobs, like, leave a dent on the universe thing. I at least wanted to leave a mark on the ad industry. And so, you know, it was those kinds of motivations going into it as a naive 26-year-old that and with, by the way, no other responsibility other than keeping myself alive. Like, that was probably an ideal time to do that and take that leap of faith.
Yeah, I totally can relate to your story. I did it in terms of starting up with a family, which was, you know, mm-hmm. very, very challenging. So you feel my pain, but I do feel like, you know, you and I talked about this before we started recording, but this is kind of another one of those opportunities, and that's why I want to talk about what you're working on. Before I get to that, I want to ask you, when you were going through, like, the courtship, because so Deep Focus was acquired by Engine Worldwide, and was that one of those things where it was best offer? Did they approach you? How did that all transpire?
Yeah, so, by the way, it was 10 years ago yesterday.
I know.
Which was incredible, like, literally to the day.
Did you plan to launch us? So, yeah, literally, well, that's a new company in a decade.
No, you know, I'll tell you, it's so weird. So Sunday night, you know, as I do every Sunday night, I look at my Monday on the calendar. 10 years ago, I put on my calendar the 10-year anniversary of the acquisition, and I'd forgotten about it, obviously, and then and I looked at my calendar, and tomorrow, my personal calendar, it's like 10 years, and I'm like, I cannot believe it. Like, I actually had an invite pay off. It was like a 10-year-old Easter egg that I had buried for myself.
Nice.
Yeah, but I would say that, I mean, what was the question again, David?
I was asking about the acquisition.
So conveniently edit that part out. So I'd almost sold the company in 2007, 5 years into it, and I'd almost sold it to Omnicom, and going through that process was interesting. What I learned, though, was not necessarily so much about the process, was about my own company. At the 11th hour during the due diligence process, we discovered that some media dollars that we had spent on behalf of clients was incorrectly classified as revenue. Innocent mistake, it does happen, but it materially changed the valuation of at least the cash component of what that deal was supposed to be. And I had a decision to make. It was either, like, do the deal as it was, because they were still willing to make the acquisition. But the problem was that it would be for future earnings, meaning nothing at closing. And I was just not comfortable with that. You know, I wanted to be compensated for what I had built. It's like, you know, the Picasso napkin story, where, you know, the woman comes in asking for, you know, for him to draw something on a napkin, and he wanted to charge her, you know, like $50,000. And she's like, that took you 2 seconds. He's like, no, it took me 50 years. Well, you know, like, I had like 8 years, like, invested in this, and paying myself next to nothing. And, you know, I wanted to be rewarded for that. And it was just, it just didn't feel like the right thing to do. It also felt like I know enough about, like, baseball free agency to know that, you know, there's a reason why there is a players union, you know, and there was no one looking out for me and my ability to earn money in the future when someone else was controlling the strings, right? And so I said, all right, you know what, I'm going to wait. I'm going to rebuild. And I retrenched, and sure enough, another economic crisis came around in 2008. But it was one that, to your point, like, we were able to turn into an advantage for us. In that, you know, we had the 6 years of experience of being a pure play digital agency that was starting to make inroads not only as a social media agency as well, but also a general ad agency. So, you know, we had become a more attractive, at that time we were only working with entertainment companies. And we had made a transition from working only with entertainment companies to also working with some pretty big brands. So brands like Microsoft and Diageo and Unilever and Nestle. And so when 2010 came around, You know, and there started to be to like again more inbound because. You know, with ad agencies, at least for a while, like once you cross like a $10 million revenue threshold, it was a pretty like easy formula for an acquiring holding company to employ. So they know that, you know, every dollar that they add to the bottom line in terms of profitability can trade in a multiple as part of their stock price. And so, you know, once it went, we were over $10 million in revenue again, and it just, you know, made sense to be having these conversations. And so at which point I had a an investment banker already working with us. And so we just basically tried to expand the universe of potential acquirers to even some non-traditionals. So I had holding companies bidding for Deep Focus. I had publishing companies bidding for Deep Focus. And I had this random British holding company called Engine bidding for Deep Focus. And as it turned out, I chose Engine because, A, they were willing to give me the greatest amount of guaranteed money, which in turn I, of course, like shared with people who helped me build the agency, you know, but then also, and I had no investors, so it was at my discretion, but then it was also about you know, being able to be on my own and make my own decisions, knowing that my bosses were 3,000 miles away. That was a really important thing, is to maintain independence, even though I was conceding it in this transaction. And just because, you know, knowing that the only thing you know about the future is that it's uncertain, just realized there were going to be a lot of twists and turns that we were going to need to navigate, and I didn't want to answer to anyone but myself for that. And that those were the terms that we agreed upon, and everything was it was fine and copacetic until, you know, 5 years later when Engine was acquired by U.S.-based private equity. You know, and that evolved things. I don't know if it changed things so much as the industry changed, and that, you know, made me want to start distancing myself from it. Not from my company, of course, but just, again, from the industry, in that I just didn't feel like it was necessarily set up for success, put it that way.
I got you. So yeah. When you, and the world's quite, I mean, as you mentioned, the world has changed quite a bit since then. And, you know, that kind of takes us into this discussion about what you're doing now, which is not advertising, fortunately.
Yeah, at all.
So you started up a company, you started a while ago, but your official launch was this week. Mm-hmm. It's called Kindred. And I'd like to know if you could tell the people kind of more about it, because I've been following, you know, you had the conference lined up and all those things, so I've been kind of following it to hear, but I'd love for you to, you know, give your pitch to the listeners.
Yeah, sure. So let me start a little bit at the beginning, in the sense that Kindred was an idea that is completely different from the way that it's materializing today originally, but it was for the same reason. And it's, strangely the same reason why I started, I walked away from advertising, which is that, you know, the radical transparency that basically has come from things like FOIA requests and just the internet in general, and just people being able to dig and find the information that they want to find, you know, it has really, pulled the curtain back on the way that companies make decisions, and the decisions that they make or the decisions that they don't make, and for what reasons. And whether that was, you know, the decisions about like diversity at the leadership level or at the employee level, or about sustainability and contributions to things like the climate crisis, people wanted to know more, and they started factoring those decisions into their purchases and into the decisions about where to work. And I saw that playing out, both, you know, certainly at the agency side, as, you know, when you're working with companies like Unilever and Nestle, you start really getting an understanding of how things like supply chains work, at least if you're mildly intellectually curious. And it's not pretty. And you're also looking at organizations that are global and or publicly traded, and understanding, you know, how the decisions that they make in many ways are there to serve the investors' needs and not necessarily the stakeholders' needs. So I realized that maybe that's the problem, the next problem that I need to solve. which is basically like all of society, right? That's a bad, like, for like a word of advice, choosing to solve all, every societal problem is probably not a good startup strategy. But it was a challenge. And it was a challenge that, you know, I said, all right, so if I wanted to do that, what's the hypothesis? And the hypothesis was that business, like better decisions, that if companies were to make better decisions for stakeholders, that I believed that that maybe had the likeliest impact on the world becoming a better place to live in. Because, you know, we can't trust governments to act quickly. And if you've ever seen a, like on C-SPAN, you know, a Senate or congressional hearing on technology, you realize, wow, like these people like generally have no idea what they're talking about. And so, you know, to get our, to wait for our elected officials to get smart about this stuff and make the right decisions, is just not probably a good strategy, right? So, so if follow the thesis that capitalism can work for us if only these companies just made, you know, much better decisions on our behalf. That's asking a lot, right? It's asking for basically a sea change and, frankly, a huge departure from, like, you know, Milton Friedman-era economics, which said the purpose of a business was to make money or to profit. Well, as we saw from, like, the Business Roundtable letter from a couple years ago, that, no, actually, they restated that the purpose of a corporation was to serve the needs of its stakeholders, which could include shareholders. But now that stakeholder and shareholder interests are aligned, and we see the markets, for example, responding to, you know, clean energy investment and things like that very favorably, and rewarding companies for having a diverse board. Like, you're starting to see the financial benefit, and the saying that doing good is good for business went from being like a very emotional argument to being a very practical one. So I thought, like, how can we get companies to change the way that they make decisions? Of course, in order to predict the future, it's probably best to look at the past. And, you know, looking backwards, I saw that the last time that this happened was actually not that long ago. And it was all about digital disruption, something that we had a front row seat to, right? And realizing that companies said that, all right, if we don't make these changes, and these were fundamental corporate strategy changes, like if we don't figure out how to embrace digital, and I don't mean like buy ads online. I mean like, you know, figure out how to, you know, measure customer acquisition costs by, you know, pushing more media to the bottom of the funnel, or how to leverage Facebook or Google ads or like things like that, things that were actually fundamental to the way that they were going to grow for the next decade or two. If they didn't figure that stuff out, or even like storage of data and cybersecurity, then they would be extinct. So they were literally facing an extinction event if they did not adapt, you know, to digital. And I feel the same thing could be true for all of the things that are happening in society, where, you know, popular culture has basically merged with corporate culture. And, you know, and Coinbase CEO memo notwithstanding, it's impossible to separate the two now, because, you know, not everything hits home, literally, right? We're all working from home now. And this was, we weren't even doing that when we started the idea for Kindred. But the idea was like, if we needed to change business leaders' perspective on things, what's the best way to do that? And this is a very 2018 decision, but why don't we just create a conference about it? And so, you know, I found a co-founder, you know, who had tremendous experience in the conference world. He had created events like Shop Talk, which is the biggest event for retail industry. He created Money 2020, which is the definitive event for the fintech, financial tech world. And I'm like, we're going to build the definitive event for social impact-driven business transformation, you know, and that's what Kindred 2020 was going to be. And up until, I would say, March of 2020, where we were about 80% of the way towards pulling off an event that was going to take place at the San Diego Convention Center in May of that year, that was what we were doing. But obviously COVID changed that plan, and we postponed our event to September. And then when May rolled around, realized that, you know what, September's not happening either. You know, we had raised money in January of 2020, which we may have been the last event business in the world to raise money. and you know, we because we had raised that money then, like we actually had money. We had cash on the balance sheet, and we were able to recoup a lot of our investment in the event, at least from a hotel and venue standpoint, and food and beverage because of force majeure. So, you know, the pitch to investors at that time was, we're going to build an event, then we're going to build a community. Well, in this kind of new era, we just leapfrogged the event, right? And so we canceled the event, and we headed straight to building a community. And that's what Kindred is now. Kindred is a professional network that is built to prepare executives for the future of socially responsible business. So at a time when, you know, all of these organizations and their leaders are being held accountable for their action on issues ranging from, like, diversity, equity, and inclusion, belonging, to allyship and sustainability and violence and poverty and food deserts, right? Education, mental health. You know, these leaders need to make decisions on behalf of their organizations because, really, like, companies don't make decisions, people do. So if we could get these people by giving them exposure to each other so they can get outside of their bubbles, by giving them exposure to experts so they can learn more about, you know, how to make these more important decisions, by, you know, giving them access to research, data, and information that they can use to inform all of those decisions, we can create a generation of leaders who are not only better prepared for the difficult decisions that they're going to have to make, but also prepare them to train the next generation of leaders who are coming up behind them. And hopefully that's a self-sustaining, you know, virtuous cycle. You know, and that's, we literally launched that yesterday publicly. But we, of course, I don't like launching by telling people what you're going to do. We launched by telling people at least to a certain degree of what we did, which was be able to launch with over 100 founding members from really incredible companies, you know, from, you know, Salesforce to Twitter to Verizon to Washington Post. So, you know, it's really an incredible group of leaders who are all in the C-suite or rapidly approaching it. I'm really excited about what they're going to do together.
Yeah, I distinctly remember the conference being in San Diego. Yeah. And then once, you know, it's one of those things, you know, you see Twitter or you read the news or watch the news or whatever, and we absorb so much information on a daily basis. But I remember specifically thinking of you when they started all the lockdowns. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, how is he going to pivot this? Because this is, I don't see this going away. Dude, and so especially how the U.S. is handling it, it's never...
I was literally on the first vacation I had taken in a couple years. I was in Aruba with my family, including my parents. And, you know, we're sitting there one night, you know, watching TV, like a late edition of CNN International, I think. You know, and the news comes on, Rudy Gobert of the Utah Jazz, right? Kind of like, he was the first, like, confirmed case of COVID in the NBA. And I was like, that's it. It's over. It's not, like, literally, like, I could see it all playing out. Like, what, like, the NBA season is going to, like, it's going to stop. You know, the, and it's not like I thought that we wouldn't be able to have an event in May at that time. It was that I thought that companies were going to respond by freezing all forms of travel. That was going to make selling tickets to an event in May really difficult, if not impossible. And so that is literally when, you know, the thoughts of pivoting started, not only like right through my brain, but probably coursing through my veins at that point.
While on vacation, no less. Maybe a pina colada in there,
too. While on vacation.
There was, so when you have 100 member... 100 member companies, big brands. Was it a hard sell when you made the outreach, gave them the pitch?
You know,
was it a tough sell or no?
So interestingly, you know, there was a decent level of awareness about who we were and what we were building and why, because of our presence in the marketplace with an event. We had almost gotten to, like, as much as you could be out there without the event actually happening. We had tickets sold, right. Sponsorship sold, you know, 150 speakers, including Chance the Rapper, lined up, right? And you know, it was – so there was some level of awareness, The pitch for what we were selling, though, was pretty new and different, and there were a lot of questions that needed to be answered, right? It's like, because at this point it was after the pandemic, and so, you know, there were questions like, how is this different than X, Y, or Z? You know, I already consider myself part of a community. Why would this help? So there was a lot of skepticism. And of course, like, if someone were to ask you to go somewhere or go to a party, right, like, the first question you ask is, well, who else is going to be there?
Yeah.
And before before the community is started, like, the answer is, well, you're going to be the first. Here's a lesson. Not many people want to be the first to do anything. right. So you almost have to, get a group of people, right, to join together. And that became the approach. So, we had some friendlies who were in from day one, including our investors, mind you. And, you know, we're blessed to have investors, not just from institutional investors, like institutional venture capital, but also investor groups like the founders of Allbirds and Warby Parker and Harry's and Casper. And they're all very mission-driven founders. Yeah, and like and they so this really spoke to them, and so they joined, and we were able to say, like, hey, like, the, you know, the Joey, the CEO of Allbirds, is a member. Like, you would really do well for yourself to be in an environment with him, because I'm sure you'd have a lot to talk about, right? And so we could use that, and that it gave us the ability to say, like, there are people already here. Like, we're not asking you to, you know, discover the new world here. We're asking you to, you know, come join something that already exists, even though we're not officially launching it until October. We decided, at least as to what we were pivoting into, around Independence Day this year. And so basically in the last 3 months, we've built this. So we had it in market in 3 months, and, you know, we surgically went after the 100 executives that we thought that would make up a community that, if you added a zero to it, it would feel just as inclusive, just as diverse, just as representative of who we wanted to be speaking to, as it would at any scale. And to do that, we also made sure that we wanted to involve nonprofits in the mix as well. Just because, you know, a bunch of business leaders talking about solving problems is just going to be or feel tone deaf if you don't have people working on those problems every day as part of the community. Or it'll just be a lot of talk and not enough action, because there needs to be some accountability here. It's great we have members that are taking accountability for themselves, which is wonderful. But you also want, nonprofits who are having a difficult time fundraising right now, especially because, and they're seeing a future for themselves where that it looks like, you know, their efforts are probably going to be just as fueled by corporate partnerships as they will with fundraising and philanthropy. It was important that they're part of the conversation, too. And so it's just a great mix of people. I'm proud of the diversity, proud of the makeup. Proud of who the individuals are that are members, and just thrilled to take it beyond this 100, to 1,000 to 2,000, and we'll see how far this can go.
And so the I don't know if you want to call it, like, the case for Kindred, so to speak, mm-hmm. You and I see what's happening out there. We follow all this stuff, but I'm a huge believer, as I know you are, in research and data.
Yeah.
And I've been watching, when I worked for a PR firm, they were big on doing surveys and polls and those kinds of things and research. And one of the big things that we saw starting in the 90s was, in the early 90s, was that trust in government was slipping, like, quickly.
Yes.
Mostly because of attacks from the right using cable news to talk about how bad government is every story. So that you take that concept, you add in a Me Too movement, you add in, like, Black Lives Matter, you add in, I mean, the timing could not be more perfect for this. And yeah. I think I even read on your own website that, like, 66% of people don't have confidence in their current leaders.
yeah.
that they'll be able to successfully address the country's challenges, which is crazy.
There's a gigantic trust deficit in the world right now, and especially in the United States. I mean, we've been told through, you know, anyone with a mouth almost, like, that that the system is rigged against us. Mm-hmm. Right? And that is, like, whether you're on the left or right, like, that is a line that you've probably heard. Or even in the middle, frankly, any human. Yeah. And I think the, you know, whether it's because of the tribalism or not, or because of social media or not, we don't even have a set of facts to agree upon anymore, it feels like. And if we don't have that, it just means that, you know, and to a certain degree, like, hope is lost. So we have to fight like hell to preserve the facts. That research and data is incredibly important, you know, to help inform the decisions. I mean, it's the science of it all. And if, you know, again, like, science should be one thing that we trust, despite what's happening right now. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think this whole thing is going to, if it works, it's going to work, because we've got a group of people here who are willing to agree on the facts, on what the problems that we need to solve. I hope they have different perspectives on how to solve them. I mean, you need that kind of friction to move forward. You know, like, wheels on wheels don't go anywhere. You know, wheels on a gravelly road, like, can go pretty fast. And, like, I think that's what we need to make happen. I think we need to be able to disagree on solutions, but agree on what the problems are. And I think, you know, when you engage in that kind of civil discourse, even in social media, it happened to me on Twitter today. I engaged in a conversation with somebody, I don't know why.
That's what Twitter was called. That was the name of Twitter originally, by the way. They had to shorten it up.
Well, I don't know why I should engage with this person when I'm going to.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was a conversation about, I guess it was about politics, but mostly about, like, you know, a comparison against, like, of conspiracy theories on the left and right. And I engage in what I think is, like, civil discourse around that topic. And the person I was engaged with sent me a direct message and said, I've never had somebody with a blue check mark engage in discourse with me on Twitter before, A. And B, I've never had somebody actually, like, respond to me, like, civilly. And which, A, is probably a reflection on them and how they conduct themselves on this platform. You know, but also, just again, just a commentary on the state of the social media union itself. You know, when you have a business model that's predicated on engagement, any kind of engagement is going to be rewarded, good or bad. And, you know, the default engagement on these platforms tends to be not necessarily good. So, you know, and this is, like, kind of the, I guess, the forbidden fruit of it all. But we bit the apple. Right. So now we have to deal with the consequences, and they're pretty dire. You know, but I think, again, like, bringing a, you know, group of people together who are optimistic, who do have hope, who know what power is and how to wield it responsibly and how to pass it along to the next generation. I mean, I just hope that this is more than a community, that it's become something, you know, like a movement, and something that can sustain itself long after I'm gone.
Well, what's nice about what you're doing is, by connecting people in these different companies, nonprofits, etc. You know, you know how this is. You've worked, when you work for somebody else and you see what's wrong in a company or what needs to be changed or how to fix something or what have you. In some companies, that can be a very, very difficult uphill battle. It reminds me of our early days, or the early days of telling the nonprofit that I worked for that I needed to redo their website, or the, you know, the website itself wasn't performing well. They didn't have goals, and they looked at me like I was speaking a foreign language. And to get anything pushed through was meeting after meeting, presentation after presentation, demo after demo, until someone finally says, okay, we'll give you a little bit of budget to redo the website. And then social media came along, and there was that whole animal, especially if you worked in any kind of regulated environment, and trying to get that sell in. And so those people that were always on that leading edge, they can be seen of one of two ways. And I think they're both, it's the same word, it's just, what's your view on this word? Is it positive or negative, which is disruptor? And for a lot of people in corporate culture, disruptors are not good things for them because it changes how they do their job every day. And it makes them think differently, potentially, and consider new ideas.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's, companies have an issue in determining what's disruption and what's distraction. I think disruption needs to be, like, very close attention needs to be paid to who is disrupting you, what is disrupting you, and why, because there is opportunity in those hills. Tons of it. It could be what your company winds up looking like. I mean, I don't want to hold up Walmart as an example because they can come do whatever they want because of the size of the company, but I think they've adapted pretty well, you know, to what they needed to do as Walmart to maintain their industrial dominance, let's call it, right? And they've retooled the company completely. I mean, it's fascinating, actually. You know, and by the way, like, that happens in much smaller instances as well with smaller companies, but Walmart is the one that we know the most about. You know, and they saw disruption as opportunity, and they decided to play offense instead of defense. If you choose to play defense, you fall into, you know, the trap of the Shirky principle, named after Clay Shirky, which is, you know, that institutions will tend to preserve whatever problem that they are the solution for.
Yep.
And I think you've seen that with newspapers, and that's why they're in the situation that they're in. It's not just their own doing, but that is a situation that it is. You know, and numerous other companies in every industry, to be honest. You know, the ones that, you know, it's people always misquote Charles Darwin when they say only the strong survive. It's not true. It's only the ones that are actually the willing or that can adapt to their surroundings that survive. That is what strength is. And so it's resilience, right? And so,
yep.
You know, what distractions are, yeah, like, especially for nonprofits, you brought that up, they're like the ice bucket challenge. Like, was that disruption or was that a distraction? I'd argue for most that actually was a distraction. It was a sign of a harbinger of things to come. But it wasn't like if you decided to go out there and say, oh, we need to create an ice bucket challenge, you probably were on a treadmill for a year, not going anywhere. You know, and like that is because that was lightning in a bottle and you can't like replicate that. Now you can change the way that you operate and change what your dependence is. But I will say that, you know, ALS, who benefited from that, had a tough time raising money when that cycle ran out.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's, you know, I think that's now why you see, and we're seeing this firsthand, why you're seeing business leaders who used to kind of ride off into the sunset with a job at a nonprofit are now starting to join nonprofits in the prime of their careers. Because nonprofits realize that they need to be run more like businesses. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, like with the rigor of a business. You know, in cutting costs, not just because they have to, but because they're the smart things to do in the right places, but spending into the, you know, the things that they need to spend on, but also because they have to forge partnerships with companies. Those corporate partnerships are necessary to offset, you know, the difficulties that these nonprofits have with fundraising. You know, and like, and that's, you know, when people are out of work, like they are today, it's just really difficult, you know, to do that, especially at a time when like every politician is asking for their money too.
Yeah.
And I'm like afraid to open email.
I just hit delete on most of them. You know,
it's hard. So it's hard.
It's the nonprofit world is a very different animal too. Most people that if you've never worked in that environment, which I have, it's a very different environment than your standard corporate environment.
They say necessity is a mother of invention, but, you know, nonprofits are not, we're never necessarily set up to be, you know, petri dishes of innovation, right? It's like they were, the contrary, they're like, no, they roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty. And I think that's incredibly important too, but they've got to be both now.
So I want to ask you about the certification program that you have on Kindred for influencers.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about that? Because it looks like, again, just trying to do the right thing put the right information in the right people's hands to help get the word out. But I'll let you tell the story about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, that idea was born out of the notion that, like, influencers are businesses too. You know, whether they're a sole proprietorship or an LLC or a house, you know, like, they are, they make money. Right. And, you know, 2 years ago, I remember having a conversation with somebody who worked at a talent agency. And, you know, one of the things that I really wanted to do with this was not just get businesses to change the way that they make decisions, but actually get influencers to do it too. And I'll be lying if I would say that that motivation wasn't because I had kids, you know, who were starting to discover social media because they were of that age. And knowing that there is no filter between them and the content that they consume like there was when I was a kid and had Saturday morning cartoons, right? Like, the FCC would say, like, what was okay for me to see as a kid. And or you had programmers who were trying to be responsible, whether because they wanted to or they had to. It doesn't matter. It's that there was a curation layer there. Well, now the curation layer is an algorithm. And like I said earlier, like, that doesn't cut it when it comes to, you know, making sure that people are exposed to content that will actually be helpful versus harmful. So how can we get influencers or creators, as I would more accurately state in this case, to be their own filter? Like, how do we get them to feel that, to understand that their platforms, you know, are not just an asset, but also a responsibility? You could appeal to their, you know, human nature to do that. But I just don't think that works generally. Like, people need to have aligned incentives in order for them to change their behavior. You know, and like, sometimes, like, you know, when you have someone who wants to quit smoking, it usually takes having a kid or getting a cancer scare to do that, right? It's like something has to trigger that behavior change. So, you know, for us, you know, it was like, how can we do that for these creators who wouldn't do something for a brand, you know, unless they got paid to get out of bed to do it. And even then, they've got a whole list of parameters around how they will do it. So realize that the answer, you didn't have to look further than the way the market was going. And that was like, as advertisers are as the conversation around brand safety was picking up, and as the conversations around brands having to do the right thing was picking up, they were starting to spend more money against communicating what they were doing in those areas, right? Like, you know, Aerie from American Eagle, you know, having their entire campaign anchored to body positivity, or Dove with curly hair, right? Like, all of these, like, a lot of these brands were starting to define themselves by their values. And if creators weren't going to do the same, they were going to find themselves less relevant, if not irrelevant, to those very brands. And they would be just like the kind of dregs of, you know, publishers that collect their ad revenue through purely programmatic media. All right. As opposed to being something that a brand would actually want to be adjacent to. So maybe argument financial, and, you know, saying that if we could create some kind of certification that a creator could say that they have done the work to achieve, that they would be perceived as more brand safe, more brand friendly to all of these advertisers who are looking to spend more with influencers, but only ones that they feel like wouldn't be a risk. Like, they don't want to spend money with a creator, you know, around some mental health initiative only to find them doing a video from like a suicide forest in Japan a week later. Like, that is just not going to cut it. And so the way to their hearts was through their wallets in some ways, but it just made them feel more comfortable talking about what was in their heart, it turns out. You know, a lot of the creators that we started working with early on in the area of mental health certification, you know, really, really felt passionately about it because, you know, they're under the pressure to keep hundreds of thousands of people happy every day. That is a recipe for a mental health crisis. So, you know, so they really started understanding that. We partnered with an incredible nonprofit called Active Minds, who operates on college campuses throughout America, making it easier for peers to talk to each other about this. And they were an ideal partner because they were all about communication, and we were all about informing the way that these creators communicated. And then we're blessed to have incredible partners like HBO, for whom mental health is a tentpole for them from a corporate social responsibility standpoint, especially, again, because they are in the business of working with talent. And talent also has that same kind of pressure, right, to tell these stories responsibly. And whether it was the, you know, the therapist story arc in The Sopranos, or the OCD story arc in Girls, or all of 6 Feet Under, right? Like, you know, they just have, like, a history of dealing with these things in a very responsible way. Gary Gulman, who's been a tremendous advocate of ours and even participant in this certification program, you know, who had a stand-up special on HBO called The Great Depression. It was an entire stand-up special about depression. I mean, that in and of itself normalized conversations that help reduce mental health stigmas. And that's the challenge that we gave to creators. It's like, help us make it easier for millions of people to talk about mental health. And then let's make the volume of those conversations too loud for everyone to ignore. And so, you know, people have gone through, hundreds of people have now gone through this mental health certification, which was a syllabus that was created by Active Minds and co-created with HBO and us. And it's only a 3-hour intensive program, and it's a 3-hour intensive program, right? And it helps these creators use better words, understand how to spot somebody in trouble, understand how to give somebody help, understand how to tell people how to give somebody else help. You know, and it's not training any of these people to be doctors or physicians, but it is teaching them to, you know, apply like basic principles of, you know, whether it's first aid, you know, or, you know, giving people advice on how to seek help that they need, or using, you know, like I said, changing the language that they use instead of using, you know, the word suicide, because that almost like paints taking someone's life as a crime, right? In the way that homicide is, right? Or genocide, right? Like we actually wind up talking about things, you know, like they died by suicide, right? Like they were the victim of something. It is not something they necessarily did to themselves on their own free will. And it just changes the framework of that conversation and just makes it, again, easier for people to have because it removes the stigma around having it. So so that certification program is alive and kicking. It launched this summer, and we're putting our second wave of creators through it right now. You know, and we're going to be launching another certification program, or another program at least, you know, with creators, you know, around another issue this winter. So it's something that continues to live, something that I'm really proud of. And again, because mostly it treats, again, creators with the respect that they deserve as business owners, as long as they're willing to accept that responsibility themselves.
So, Ian, that sounds amazing. I think it's, you know, obviously admirable. So in terms of member benefits, like what, you apply, right? There's an application process you go through. Mm-hmm. And let people know how they can become members, basically, because I want people to understand that they can get involved in this, not just listen to a podcast and then forget about it, but actually go to, you know, your website, kindredmembers.com, and sign up.
Yep. So that is step one. The application process, once you click the apply button on the site, is fairly straightforward. It gives us information that, if you are accepted, helps us tailor the experience for you. The application process is not about, you know, getting the elite, you know, business leaders in here. It's actually to the opposite, right? It's to ensure that we're making sure that we've got like a great and diverse group of leaders who are joining this network and participating in the community. And it's also designed to allow us to meter membership as we add it, right? And so, you know what it's like when, like, you've seen the footage of, like, every, like, the day after Thanksgiving every year where it's, like, everyone kind of bum rushes a Walmart, right? Like, because the door's open. I'm not saying that, you know, like, you know, there are a million executives just waiting to get accepted into Kindred yet. You know, but the idea is that there is a very clear path towards a lot of people wanting to join at once. In fact, yesterday when we launched, we had more applications come through in the hours following that than we did in the 2 weeks preceding it, right? And so, it's that's going to happen, especially as people talk more and more about becoming or about being part of our network. So it's important for us to meter admission in that way. And so, you know, we have like a rolling admissions and acceptance process, but it's also to make sure that everyone that's joining is capable of making important decisions inside of their organization. We have ways for people who aren't yet in that position or in that position of power to participate in our programming. In fact, if you are a Kindred member, you get like guest passes to bring people from your organization along for the ride throughout the year. So we are making sure that people you know, who want to participate get exposed to it early on. But the application process is important for that, right? Yep. For that reason. And so fill out the application. It literally takes, you know, a couple of minutes. So it's not that difficult. And then you'll hear from us shortly, you know, as to what the process looks like, what the timing might be. There is a fee for membership, and it is different for profits and nonprofits. You know, for for-profits up until the end of the year, and for listeners of this podcast, I'm willing to extend our founding membership pricing to $5,200 per member. For nonprofits, the price is half of that. And I can assure you that that the return on that investment is huge. I mean, if for savings alone on the curative work that we're doing and making sure that we've got literally the best experts at all of these issues that members can have access to, and content can be consumed either live, which is preferred, and it's kind of like Peloton, right? Like, I guess you can like participate in a Peloton class live, and it's one experience, or you can do it on demand, and it's a different experience. Yeah. But it's good for you nonetheless.
Well, I appreciate the detailed information. Before we get to wrap this up, I have two things for you. You're a big baseball fan. You're a Mets fan in particular.
Yes.
Are you hopeful now that you have new owners? This comes from a Pistons fan, a Lions fan, like.
Yeah. So, you know, hopeful. I'm hopeful. Like, one of the things that I love about baseball is that I never feel more optimistic than I do on opening day. It's like, you know, it's like a new beginning every year, right? And I think as we've seen, you know, with every season, like almost anything can happen. But it's hard for like anything really good to happen if you honestly like have ownership who, or leadership, right? Where the culture isn't right. And I think if you look at dysfunctional organizations, and as a New Yorker, I have the front row seat to a few of them. You know, it's really difficult to create a winning culture inside of a dysfunctional organization. I'm thrilled about the new ownership situation in New York. I think there is not only a reboot of the franchise that's going to be underway, but also retention of the core, that what's make the you of what gives it like actually such promise. It's and the promise that we had going into the season, but I also think it means smarter spending.
Yep.
I don't mean more spending. I mean smarter spending. And so whether that's investments in analytics, or investments in talent, I think, both of those are going to be made. And you know, again, it's like, I feel like this is like this opening day is going to take on different meaning as far as new beginnings go. And I'm really looking forward to it. And I can only hope for the same, at some point with the Knicks.
Yeah. There's so many, as a Lions fan, you know,
man, it's hard. I feel for you so much, man. Like, it is hard, like, to watch, like, you talk about like futility. Yeah. I mean, I think the Lions franchise, which by the way, when you think about it, has had some of the greatest players to have come through the league in the last 25 years.
And purposely walk because of ownership.
Yeah. And it's I can't imagine how frustrating that must be.
You get to a point especially where you're apathetic. You're like, we're going to suck again this year. And you watch the first however many games of the year, and you see the problems, and you see no solutions, and you see bad communication and bad leadership. And you're just like, here we go again. It's literally Groundhog Day.
Yeah, I have so much things to say, but this is not a Detroit Lions podcast.
So five quick this or that questions for you.
Yes.
So first one, coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Figure that one right. Soft serve or froyo?
Froyo, because I'm lactose intolerant, and it's more likely that I can find lactose-free frozen yogurt.
Sparkling or still?
Ah, I think those are case sensitive. There's a time for each.
Exactly. Baseball or hockey?
But definitely baseball. Yeah. But I do love hockey.
Netflix or Hulu?
By screen time, Netflix.
Yeah. And my bonus question is: Democratic Republic or authoritarianism?
Oh, Democratic Republic.
All right, Ian. So give Ian a follow, by the way, on Twitter. He's iShafer, and I'll link to it in the description of the podcast. You can follow Kindred on Twitter at @Kindred, which, you know, good job on securing that one, on that handle.
Thank you.
Go to his website, or the website for Kindred is kindredmembers.com, and you can find the rest of their social media accounts from there as well. Ian, I'm always a big fan of your work. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Right back at you, David. Looking forward to doing a part two when we've got so much more to talk about.
I will take you up on that, my friend.
All right.